This is Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Abraham Ribicoff. Secretary Ribicoff believes that the Kennedy administration's domestic record represents a success on the new frontier. This is Senator Everett McKinley Dirksen, Republican of Illinois and Senate Minority Leader. Senator Dirksen believes the administration's domestic record represents a failure on the new frontier.
The compact Mercury Comet and the big, luxurious Mercury Monterey, best-looking buys now in each size, present The Nation's Future. From Chicago, the premier debate in a new season of The Nation's Future. Tonight, the administration's domestic record, success or failure. Our speakers, Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Abraham Ribicoff, and Senator Everett McKinley Dirksen, Republican of Illinois. In our audience, government officials, political figures, journalists, the general public. And now here is our moderator, noted news correspondent, Edwin Newman.
Good evening. Welcome to the premier debate in the new season of The Nation's Future. In the coming months, we will be bringing you again the foremost spokesman of our time in major debates on topics of national and international importance. Again, it will be my pleasure to act as moderator for the series. Tonight, a debate on the Kennedy administration's domestic record. This is an appropriate time for such a debate. Congress adjourned late last month, and its achievements or failures are being vigorously argued. Criticism of the administration's record has intensified, and administration spokesmen have come to the defense of that record. Meanwhile, both parties are already gearing up for the 1962 congressional elections. Our debate will begin in a moment after these words about the 1962 Mercurys.
This week, Mercury invites you to look into 1962 and look twice at two quality-built Mercurys. The compact-size Mercury Comet. The big-size Mercury Monterey, best-looking buy for the big car man. This year, Mercury has the size you want at a price you'll like. Whether a big car like this luxurious Monterey or a smart compact like this jaunty new Mercury Comet, smartly ahead of the compact crowd. Each new Mercury gives you more room, more quality, a lot more car than any others near its price. This week, come size up both new 62 Mercurys. The compact Mercury Comet. The big, luxurious Mercury Monterey. Best looking buys, now in each size.
Abraham Ribicoff was appointed Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare by President Kennedy in January of this year. Before joining the cabinet, Mr. Ribicoff served as Governor of Connecticut for 6 years. Mr. Secretary, your position, please.
On January 20th, John F. Kennedy came to the presidency with the hopes and prayers of the people of America. Today, those hopes and prayers have been justified by the record of President Kennedy, his own actions as president, and what has been accomplished during this session of Congress. The president was faced with a great problem, and the nation was faced with a great problem. We were in the midst of our third recession, a deep one, in 6 years. 5,700,000 people were out of work. Wages were down. Farm income was down. Steel was only working part-time. Gold was flowing out of the country. People were hungry. The first job that the president had was to make sure that this nation moved ahead and that our economy picked up. Immediately, the president moved to make sure that the people were fed by executive order. Those who were on relief got more food, quantity, and quality to feed them. Unemployment compensation had run out for some 600,000 Americans, and they were in desperate plight, and the first measure that was passed by the Congress was an extension of unemployment compensation. Some 750,000 children of dependent children of unemployed workers were hungry, and Congress passed an act to make sure that there was aid to the children of the unemployed. The president was faced with the problem of the rise in cost having had a great impact on those people, our elder citizens, on Social Security, and there were amendments to the Social Security bill. So the president moved ahead on many fronts economically. Housing was passed, a substantial housing bill. Measures were passed in the field of commerce to make sure that our economy moved ahead, and it has moved ahead. So today, we have a situation where we have the highest employment in the history of our country, some 3 million people more than when the president came to office. Unemployment has gone down to some 4 million people. I recall, to indicate the president's thinking, that I was in his drawing room, and he picked up the paper. And as he looked at the paper, turning the ads, he turned to me and said, "Abe, I can't understand how the Republicans can be against $1.25 minimum wage. With the prices as they are, how can any family live on less than $50 a week? And I can't understand how Senator Dirksen and the Republicans oppose such a measure." Now, I don't want you to think that we have had all successes, because we did have a failure in education, because what happened there, many of our own men joined the opposition, and we were ambushed between Indiana and Illinois.
Thank you, sir. Everett McKinley Dirksen was elected senator from Illinois in 1950 and has served in the Senate ever since. He is a member of the Republican Policy Committee and Senate Minority Leader for the 86th Congress. Senator Dirksen, may we have your position, please?
First, I'm glad to see the Secretary. We served together in the House of Representatives, and I esteem him as an old friend. Let me start by alluding to a dispatch in the Washington Post, incidentally a very liberal pro-administration paper, which appeared on the 15th of September, about 10 days before adjournment. In that dispatch was carried this quote: "This bill," meaning the Peace Corps bill, "was the first bill, contrary to all the retreads that have been considered, that has hit the floor of the House." What they were saying in that report is that so much of the administration legislation had been long in its incubation under a Republican administration. It wasn't particularly world-shaking. It was picking up the stitches of the Eisenhower administration, and actually there was nothing new. Now, when you evaluate and appraise whether an administration is a success or a failure, I think you have to include, first, those rather glowing pledges that were made in California in July of 1960. I think you have to include all the promises that were made in the course of the campaign. I think you have to include the impact of the measures after they were passed. And on the whole, I do not put that kind of a tag on the administration. I simply say that it didn't fully meet the expectations of the people and the Congress. And I must add one other thing. When an administration advances a measure, the real criteria must necessarily be what happened to it in the Congress before it got out. And when you take note of how a Congress, where there is a Democrat majority of 3-2 in the House and 2-1 virtually in the United States Senate, I say simply that the administration was not up to expectations, and if you want to translate that into the term of failure, you can do so. Now, the failures are never recounted. I saw this glowing sheet that was gotten out about 3 weeks ago showing the 33 major accomplishments of the administration. The interesting thing about that is that there were only 12 roll calls on the 33 measures to indicate that there was no real controversy about most of them. And so, looking at it in the large and taking a perspective look, I think in that respect, the administration has failed to fully requite its obligations and meet our expectations.
Thank you, sir. Now, before Secretary Ribicoff and Senator Dirksen cross-examine each other, these words about the 1962 Mercurys.
C is for Cullen, Bill Cullen.
C is for Collins, Dorothy Collins.
C is for Comet. Mercury Comet.
The new Mercury Comet S22 with the roofline that makes other compacts so jealous.
Inside like a sports car. Oh, but lots more room. Real bucket seats, his and hers. Adjust separately. You can sit up, he can stretch back.
In between, the new Mercury Comet's map locker. Standard equipment and handy.
Dandy for compacts and things.
In your compacts. And notice this bright new steering wheel.
Elegant. And so are the six shiny new taillights.
If you forget six taillights, remember that...
C means come see all the new Mercury.
The compact Mercury Comet. The big, luxurious Mercury Monterey. Best looking buys, now in each size.
Now our time for Secretary Ribicoff and Senator Dirksen to question each other, to cross-examine each other, and to discuss the issues that have been raised. Secretary Ribicoff, would you begin?
Yes, I would. I'm rather surprised that an old political hand like Senator Dirksen, and I consider myself an old political hand, talks about new ideas in government. Frankly, there are very few new ideas in government. The test of government and the test of leadership is who translates those ideas and measures into action. Now, President Kennedy certainly was able to translate measures that have been kicking around Congress for many years. Let me give you a few examples. The Depressed Area Bill, which would help so many areas in the United States which are suffering in a depressed state. This couldn't go through under the Eisenhower administration. We need clean water. We need it desperately in the United States. This failed in the Eisenhower administration. Now some 5,000 communities will have clean water because this was passed under the Kennedy administration. Juvenile delinquency. For years, they've been trying to get a juvenile delinquency bill through the Congress of the United States. It failed. This year, we will start attacking the problem of juvenile delinquency. The question of crime that spans the nation. They've been trying to get bills through for 40, 50 years in the Congress, only to fail, and the Kennedy administration was able to bring it to fruition. So the test here is a success of the Kennedy administration and the president to pass through Congress legislation that was stymied under Republican leadership during the previous 8 years.
Well, we haven't had a Republican Senate or a Republican House for quite some time. So if my distinguished friend, the Secretary, wants to place the blame up there, then, of course, he must place it on the Democrats in both houses of Congress.
That's not so at all, because your president vetoed some of this vital legislation. Keep in mind, a water pollution bill was vetoed, the area development bill was vetoed. These were vital legislation for the benefit of our nation. The housing was vetoed. These were measures that Democratic Congresses passed only to have your own Republican president vetoed.
Now let's take a look. With respect to distressed areas, the president not only vetoed it once, he vetoed it twice. He insisted that certain criteria be included. And at long last, that criteria was included before the Congress under this administration passed the bill. Now, I said in my opening remarks that not the least of the criteria in measuring success or failure is the ultimate impact of the bill. Distressed areas has been on the books for 5 long months. Mr. Kennedy said in the campaign, action, movement, motion, results. That's what we want. Oh, let me finish. And as a result, it's been on the books for 5 months. We gave them $394 million, and in 5 months, two sewer projects aggregating $373,000 has been disbursed.
Well, I would say this as a man who's been on the administrative end of government, 5 months after a piece of legislation becomes law is a short time, because communities must organize, applications must be made, chambers of commerce must get behind a measure, and 5 months is a very short period of time to put into effect the important measures in a depressed area bill. And if this is the answer of Senator Dirksen and the Republicans, I would say that it is pretty weak gruel, as a matter of fact. Let us see what happens in a period of a year as these communities with some 20 million plus people will depend upon the stimulus given by the Depressed Areas Bill, which is so important for the people of our nation.
Now, with respect to pollution, and I must follow up, if success depends on spending federal money, then this administration has been a rousing success. The expenditure budget shows $95.8 billion. And if you add the trust accounts, it will come to the neighborhood of $114 billion. And a good Democrat like Harry Byrd estimates that by 1965, it will be up to $137 billion. So I must give them a pat on the back if that is the measure of success.
Well,
but let's not lose sight of pollution. There was a pollution program. There has been a pollution program for a long time. You see, when I talk about money, the new administration simply doubled it. And then they did infinitely more.
Well, that's not quite true, Senator Dirksen.
Oh, I'll show you in your own sheet from the White House.
This is a question of the own sheet. But keep this in mind when it comes to money, that the Kennedy administration, the basic increases went for defense to keep this country going. And some $4 million of the $6 million additional in the Kennedy budget over the Eisenhower budget went for missiles, went for Polaris submarines, went for space, in order to make sure that the United States, which was slipping behind, the United States would advance ahead. Now, this is an old Republican argument talking about spending money. Basically, the president is a pretty tight guy when it comes to spending a buck. This I can tell you from long experience. And President Kennedy isn't advocating the expenditure of a dime that isn't absolutely essential for the advancement of the United States of America at home and abroad. Now, basically, when you analyze the budget, this is where the money has gone to. Some $4 billion for additional defense to get America's superiority moving again. Some $1.5 billion for college housing, for loans to small business that will be repaid back. Now, what will happen 5 or 10 years from now, I don't know, and you don't know, but we are a big country, and we're growing fast, and I know that this country must move ahead domestically as well as internationally, and we are generating the wealth to be able to take care of basic American needs. Now,
Abe, to show you, I'm not talking by the card. This is the sheet that Ted Sorensen, the president's personal advisor, and Larry O'Brien, his liaison man to the Senate and the House, got out and first exhibited to 30 selected newspaper men. This was done in the White House. I didn't do this. And what does it say here? Stream pollution, 5-year doubling of the program. And under that program, you don't even have to live on a stream in order to get a stream pollution grant, as I understand it.
Well, now you're talking about something that I know because I will administer that order.
I know you will.
And this is one of the greatest steps forward for clean water, because no civilization, no nation can exist without clean water. Clean water to drink, clean water for recreation, clean water for industrial purposes. And the streams of America, the rivers of America, the lakes of America is an outstanding disgrace for the future of this country, and we must clean up our streams. For every dollar of federal money that will be spent, there will be $5 of local money spent. And this is the only way to get going because many of these streams and waters are in interstate commerce. And since the nation has a vested interest in the water to keep our nation going, there could be no better investment for the future of America than this water. And I am proud that Congress was able to do, under the leadership of President Kennedy, what the Eisenhower administration wouldn't do, help clean up the waters and streams of the United States.
Well, now, now, Mr. Chairman, the Secretary was never more mistaken in his life. There has been a stream pollution program for a great many years under Eisenhower. This, I leave it to some of my congressional friends who are sitting here in the audience. They just doubled the program was all. And that's why I said in my opening statement, when you discount the retreads, then you wonder whether they met the expectations of the people.
Not only would it would certainly double, but this is a big country with a lot of streams, and the country has to have its water resources doubled. Furthermore, what the Eisenhower administration had on water pollution was pretty weak, with no teeth in it, no enforcement powers. And if you are going to be able to clean up the streams of America, you have to have the power and some guts in administration to make sure that you clean up the streams. And I am very proud that this program will allow some 5,000 communities in the United States to clean up their streams. And this is very good and an addition. a program to take the salt out of water, the brackishness out of inland waters, and hear what a great opportunity there is for the United States at home and abroad to make the sea drinkable and to make water available to starved and parched nations and make deserts bloom. This is how America goes forward under a man like John Kennedy, a president with imagination, a president with courage, who is willing to move ahead and move ahead continuously.
Now let's look at...
May I suggest at this point that we push on from pollution to some other point?
Well, let's get it to salinity. Actually, that program started under Eisenhower. You had to do the research and development work first. We had the pilot plants built. And all that the Kennedy administration did, my friend, was to come and ask for $75 million to build some larger plant.
But you have complained, Senator Dirksen. But this is the point. You complain about spending money. But the Eisenhower administration refused to spend the money to eliminate salinity. But the Kennedy administration, recognizing the basic needs of our nation's future, was willing to spend $75 million to take the salt out of the sea and make the deserts bloom. And this is a difference between the Democratic approach and the Republican approach, because the Democrats move forward.
Now, my good friend, the Secretary, mentioned the housing program. You see, in this sheet that was gotten out by the White House staff, says the most comprehensive housing program. It certainly was. In terms of dollars, it would cost more than any program that was ever offered. But now, I mention in my preliminary statement that it's the quality of the legislation also. And when the president sent that bill to the Senate and to the House, what was in it for housing? Nothing down and 40 years to pay. And yet the Federal Housing Administration will not insure a roof or get a guarantee on a roof on one of those houses that'll last beyond 10 years. So we had to maul the program. They had $100 million in it to buy open spaces. I thought perhaps that was a local problem. And the conference report finally cut it to $50 million.
Of course,
but imagine the idea of coming with a program, nothing down, 40 years to pay, and an open invitation to abandon and let the government hold
the
staff.
But the interesting
thing,
that was
the housing program.
The final vote on the housing program had 85% of the House Republicans voting against it and 59% of the Senate Republicans voting against it. This came out a comprehensive program to take care of low income, to take care of middle income, to take care of more urban renewal, to clean up our cities like Chicago is being cleaned up, its slums, to eliminate these slums. Again, this is important. This is the faith that the Democrats and President Kennedy has in the future of America and its people to be able to build our future economically, knowing that out of this wealth we will generate the tax revenues to be able to pay for the bill. In the meanwhile, we will have people living decently instead of in the slums of the United States.
Mr. Secretary, you mentioned that the education bill that you were proposing had failed.
Yes, sir.
Why do you think it failed?
Well, I would say this. There was a pretty good operation going on between the Republicans and a few of our own boys. You take the Rules Committee, which blocked this measure. There were five Republicans on the Rules Committee, all Republicans. Now, each and every one of those Republicans voted against allowing these measures to come to the floor. They were joined by three Democrats, making eight, and seven Democrats voted for it. Now, I know that a man like Senator Dirksen shouldn't have too much difficulty to convince or induce his friend Charlie Halleck to get one Republican vote on the Rules Committee to let that bill be considered. And if we only had one Republican vote out of five, there would have been an opportunity to vote for this measure. But the Republicans, of five of them, as I say, we were ambushed on the new frontier by the five Republicans and three Democrats. We've had a few more ambushes like that, as some of our own boys, I will admit, joined with the Republicans. They've done it before, and this is a tough job. It's a tough job, and we have to go ahead with it. Because let me say this to you, Ed, that as far as the president is concerned, he's not a quitter. I'm not a quitter. Education is important for the future of our nation, and we are going to put through an educational program in the United States, and I hope we can get a few Republican votes in the next session of Congress.
Now, Now let me tell you the whole story. In the House of Representatives, they have a Rules Committee. It's the steering committee. A committee reports a policy bill. It has to go to the Rules Committee, get a rule for its consideration on the floor. The first thing that the Kennedy administration did was to pack the Rules Committee and put on two Democrats for every Republican. And yet they got their bill stopped in that committee, notwithstanding all the Democrats.
All I can say, this is very important. And this is a weakness that I acknowledge in the Democratic Party. I want to say I acknowledge this weakness. There's one thing I admire as a politician about the Republican Party. When Ev and Charlie snap that whip, the boys march. And there's no question about it. I'm envious. I wish that when our leader snapped the whip, the Democrats would march the same way, but they don't. But these boys play a pretty good game, Ev and Charlie, because they keep on always getting a few of these men who have go along with their philosophy and are able to stymie this bill. Now, we did put two more men on the Rules Committee, but those five Republicans stuck together like the Rock of Gibraltar, and they only needed three. And when you consider that seven Democrats voted to allow consideration, for the life of me, if the Republicans are interested in education, I can't understand why at least one Republican out of five didn't join seven Democrats to allow this measure to be even discussed on the floor of the House.
Well, the answer is very simple. If you've got 10 Democrat soldiers on one side and five Republican soldiers on the other, and a Democrat president still can't get it out of the Rules Committee, there must be something wrong with the legislation, and there was.
Let me say this to you, Ev. This was good legislation, but just to see again, this was a tough bill. Basically, this started in 1946. A great Republican advocated this, a man who was greatly admired by Senator Dirksen. Robert Taft, in 1946, was one of the first to advocate federal grants to the states for education. It's been blocked since that time, and it has been a very tough fight. Now, the important things in education are teachers' salaries, in my mind, and scholarships. Yet, when that bill was under consideration in the House Committee on Education and Labor, each and every Republican voted against the teachers of America. And this is what I can't understand. Now, we did lose some votes. We did lose some Democratic votes. But when something is so important as education, I don't understand why at least you can't get a few Republicans to opt for education and the future of the young people of America.
Now, let me make it clear that the Republicans never voted against the teachers of the country. They voted that way because out of the secretary's own shop in the Office of Education, there came a brochure, a federal system of education. And as you read it, you could look down the road and see the inexorable result of this bill. It meant a long bureaucratic hand of his agency controlling education.
This is very, very interesting. That brochure was drafted by a committee designated in October of 1960 by Secretary Fleming, and everybody on that committee were appointees of a Republican administration on civil service who held over, and they issued that report, and it was a Republican committee appointed by my predecessor that issued that report and not a committee appointed by me.
Well, now the secretary knows that Mr. Fleming got exactly nowhere. He was a Republican secretary of that department, and I resisted and opposed him, and so did the Republicans, because we didn't care whether it was Arthur Fleming, a Republican, or Abe Ribicoff, a Democrat. We could see down the road as to the ultimate result, namely the federal control of education. That was going to be the inexorable end result.
I can say this, Senator, I can say that this argument, I'm not accusing you of the argument, but the opponents of this who use this argument are guilty of hypocrisy of the worst order, because the same men who are worried about federal aid to education and control are the same men who vote for the federally impacted area money. A lot of that money comes to Illinois. A lot of that money comes to all the 50 states. And this money is used for teacher salaries, and this money is used as well as to build schoolhouses. In my 6 years as governor, in my 8 months as secretary, I have never known a school superintendent, a mayor, a congressman, or a principal who has ever pointed out where the federal government has ever tried to control how education is taught, what teachers are taught, or how schoolhouses will be built. And this is a program which pays and is used by one-third of the school pupils of America, federally impacted money. Now, if there are other communities in the United States of America that are impacted, I know no reason why any child in America has to go to a fire trap for a school, has to have a poorly trained teacher, and if that money is good enough to be voted for federally aid to impacted areas, it's good enough to be voted on the same principle for the needy school children and the quality teachers of the United States as well.
There is no more... There is no more analogy between federal aid to education as they dished it up and impacted areas than there is between the moon and the deep sea, and I'll tell you why. We have put cantonments and military installations all over the country. We've sent soldiers there. We allowed them to take their wives and children. The result was what? We dumped a whole concourse of school children upon the school districts in every state in the Union. And the result was what? Sometimes they didn't have the assessable value to take care of it. And what were these impacted area payments? In principle, completely different from what the Secretary said. These were payments in lieu of taxes that the people back home would have to pay.
Now, I'd like to straighten out this record.
I would like to put an end to the education part of the debate. Would you be brief?
Yes, I will. 1.5 million children are so covered in military establishments and defense establishments. But 10 million children are the beneficiaries in these particular areas. Furthermore, the bill that was drawn specifically provided that these funds would go to the states, and the states would distribute those to the needy districts, and the states would make the choice, so the federal government would have no way to control where this education money went.
But the fact remains that the money was available only where you had federal installations. And it was done because of the tax burden. And if there had been no military installation, there would have been no money. Under the Secretary's proposal, didn't make any difference whether you had installations or not. This money was going to be scattered all over the country on a pro-rata basis.
May I put a more general question to you now? I would hope for a brief answer. Which party came out of the last session of Congress with an improved political standing in the country? Would you go first, sir?
Well, obviously the Republican Party. Could there be another answer? You need amplification?
Please.
We knocked the rough corners off of many things. If I could go into the foreign aid field, I could give you a classic example. But the fact of the matter is that in agriculture, in housing, and elsewhere, some of these very fantastic and impossible proposals were taken out of those bills before they ever got to the president's desk. And we did it when there were twice as many new frontiersmen on the other side of the aisle as the number of soldiers who serve under my belt.
All I can say to you is this. I'm in the process of stumping the country, and I've been taking some soundings myself, and President Kennedy never stood as high in the hearts of his countrymen as he stands today. President Kennedy came to the presidency by a very, very small margin of vote. But if the election were held today, he would sweep in with an overwhelming majority.
Thank you, gentlemen. That's all the time we have now for discussion. I'm sure our audience, however, has questions it would like to put to you, and we'll get to them after these words about the 1962 Mercuries.
Strike a big match. Stroke a big dog. Stretch back in a big new 62 Mercury Monterey, and you've just slammed a door on all your cares. Gives you a big feeling, Mercury Monterey. A jackpot feeling. It's loaded with wide-open spaces. And drive? Man, Mercury Monterey has more heft, brawn, and room than other cars in its class. Yet it aims and handles like a pistol, stops like a speed camera. And watch when he triggers that big engine. Pow! For 62, here's the best-looking buy for the big car man. Mercury Monterey. See both 62 Mercuries. This week, Mercury invites you to inspect the best-looking buys now in each size. Look at the Mercury Monterey, best-looking buy for the big car man. And look twice at Comet, the compact that's smartly ahead of the compact crowd.
Bill Collins got a secret.
So does Dorothy Collins.
Why we fell in love with the 62 Mercury Comet. It all began
with the price tag. Mercury Comet's priced with or below most compacts.
A price tag? On that gorgeous Comet roofline?
Oh, it's a great roofline, Dorothy, but did you check the wheelbase?
Nope. Does it have one?
Does it? Longest on any compact. Watch. Wheelbase is the distance from front to back wheel. Too short? Bumpy ride. Long like a Comet? Ride smooth like a sailboat because it's got the longest wheelbase of any compact.
Swing on down and see the beautiful wheelbases on all the new Mercuries.
The compact Mercury Comet. The big, luxurious Mercury Monterey. Best looking buys, now in each size.
This is the part of the program that we devote to questions from the audience, but before we go there, perhaps I can get Senator Dirksen and Secretary Ribbicoff in the vein by putting this question to them. Do you regard the recession as over? And if you do, who gets the credit? Mr. Secretary, would
I
you
would begin? Say that it was the president's program and his determination to get America moving forward. He started immediately by releasing a substantial sum of money for the road building program. He started the housing program moving. The $500 million was made available for the unemployed people. The ability, then of course the dividends that were paid on the veterans insurance, the tax refunds, the realization by the president that we must do everything possible, the lowering of interest rates. Now, the president moved immediately. He moved swiftly on the economic front. And this has been the shortest recession that we've had. And in addition, not only is steel going up, not only is housing starts going up, but one of the greatest factors, you may recall that in the 15-month period before the president came to office, there was such a run on gold that gold was leaving Fort Knox because of lack of confidence in our stability. Now, since President Kennedy has been in office, gold has started to go back into Fort Knox, which just goes to show the confidence all over the world in the stability of the American economy.
Senator?
Well, whether a recession is over or not is probably a matter of statistics. I took a look at the economic indicator, which incidentally is issued by the Council of Economic Advisors at the White House. You see, I always go back to the other side for my documentation. But I see that the unemployment quotient in the country for August was 1%, 1 1/10% higher than it was in August of 1960. To be sure, there have been additions to the civilian labor force. But if the recession is over, we still have a structural unemployment problem.
I don't understand this because the figures issued this week indicates that unemployment at the present time is a little over 4 million. When President Kennedy came to office, unemployment was 5,700,000. Furthermore, we have today some 3 million more people employed than when President Kennedy came to office. And if you talk about figures having significance, I know of no figures that have greater significance when they're translated into jobs, and jobs are translated into food and rent and sustenance for our people, and our gross national product is going up, business is good, the stock market is moving, and the difference between our economy today and when President Kennedy came to office is fantastically encouraging, and it has been a signal success for President Kennedy.
Now, perhaps I can finish my answer. That is a documented figure. I didn't get that out of a hole in my head. I get that out of the report of the Board of Economic Advisors appointed by the President of the United States. But so there still is a structural unemployment problem.
Senator Dirksen is talking about August. We happen to be in the month of October right now.
I want to go to the audience for questions.
Wait a minute.
Please.
This has got to be cured. Actually, you don't get the August figures until now. I just got them.
No, but basically the report was just made this week by the Labor Department, and the statistics of the Labor Department are not questioned as far as their authenticity.
Well, now I will go to the audience for questions. I'll state the rules very briefly. If you want to ask a question, raise your hand. If I call on you, please rise, give your name, indicate to whom your question is addressed, state your question briefly and directly. This lady.
Hi, this is Robert Meany. I have a question on education, Mr. Ribicoff. How many persons have been added to your department since this administration came in?
The number of people added to our department are reflected by the programs passed by the Congress of the United States. The Congress of the United States will pass a juvenile delinquency program, will enlarge Social Security, aid to dependent children, and the Congress of the United States, and I am sure that there were no demurrers or no failure to vote for it, where appropriations go through to take care of the programs that are there. And this department is growing in numbers, and it grows in numbers, and the reason it grows in numbers is because we are doing more for the people of America by action taken by the Congress of the United States. Senator?
I can tell you how many I think for the entire government, not for Mr. Ribicoff's department. But if I recall now, something in excess of 60,000 new people have been added to the federal rolls since the new administration came into power.
But these are programs that are continuous. These are programs, some of them started in the previous administration, and these are programs that are needed to keep the government moving as the country grows. Gentlemen there.
My name is Robert Rosenbluth. Secretary Ribicoff will remember that in the Democratic National platform and in his own state platform, they were pledged to have a youth conservation corps. That didn't pass Congress. Why?
Well, I think that bill is one of the bills that are blocked in that famous Rules Committee.
Yeah. It got stuck in a Democrat Congress.
I'd like to address this to Senator Dirksen. What is your main objection to this year's federal aid bill, and how would you have improved it?
I don't think I'll allow a question on federal aid. This is a matter of a domestic record of the administration. Lady here.
My name is Dorothy Dietz, and I have a question to direct to Senator Dirksen. Has the reluctance of Congress to support Mr. Kennedy's domestic program in its original form been due in part to a growing grassroots opposition to the program by the American people?
I think that's a pretty good statement. As a matter of fact, there's been a growth of conservative sentiment in the country today. I think the young people particularly are becoming aware not only of the high budget, but of the commitments that are written in that then become effective in future years. And you see, you're one of those who's going to pay the bill. And that's the reason there's a great awareness. People are wondering about the solvency of their country. And when you go too far, what do? You shake that very delicate fabric of confidence, and not even the spending proclivities of the new frontier are going to save us if that ever goes
out. All I can say is I want to say right here that I have confidence in this country today and the country's future. I am not as pessimistic as Senator Dirksen is. And basically, this country will go forward, and this country is going forward. And this is not a spendthrift administration. This is an administration that is only spending for basic needs to keep this country going forward, and we cannot stand still in the United States of America. Gentlemen.
Byron Gomberg, my question is directed to Secretary Ribicoff. You alluded to juvenile delinquency. Could you mention in what manner the federal government is attacking this program?
Yes. The federal government has passed a program in which there will be pilot programs in key areas of the United States to see whether we can bring together the best programs that are being used throughout the nation to make an overall attack on the problem of juvenile delinquency. That's one part of the program. The second part of the program has to do with the training of people to work with our youngsters. We are fantastically short, not only in courts, not only in probation, in the fields of recreation, and in trained personnel to work with the youngsters of America. And this program is so set up that not only will we have pilot programs to attack juvenile delinquency, but also to train the personnel to work with the youngsters of America.
Comment, Sal?
I recognize that juvenile delinquency is a problem. As a matter of fact, a Republican senator from New Jersey was the first one to put some steam into the thing. So here is a three-year program to cost $10 million. But if an equal amount of emphasis were placed on the churches and the homes where these derelictions begin, I'm not so sure we'd be infinitely better off than training people in government. But I went along with the program, not to study it.
A moment. We'll have more questions and more answers in a moment, but right now, a message about the 1962 Mercurys.
Big boots, big shoulders, big country all around. For a big man in a big quality-built 62 Mercury Monterey gives a guy a rangy feeling, this car. Plenty of horsepower, wide sweeping windshield, room inside big as the plane, and handle, watch. This year, let out the stirrups on legroom and let out the reins on luxury. For extra value, for solid quality, try a top-line 62 Mercury Monterey, one of the great 62 Mercurys. The compact Mercury Comet. The big, luxurious Mercury Monterey. Best-looking buys, now in each size.
Now we go again to our audience for questions. A gentleman there.
My name is Ted Cobb. I have a question for Secretary Ribbentrop. The principle of executive action in the field of race relations is one which has been very interesting. I'd like to hear your comment on its adequacy.
Yes, I would say that there are many phases in the field of civil rights. There's legislatively, and there's an executive action. On an executive basis, the president has moved in many ways, and one of the most important is a recognition of the worth and the value of every man, irrespective of the color of his skin. President Kennedy has appointed more Negroes to high public office than all his predecessors in the past 60 years. We have two federal judges, Negroes. We have two United States attorneys, Negroes. We have assistant secretaries. We have Mr. Weaver, care of federal housing. We have Mr. Rowan. We have Andy Hatcher. In my own department, Lyle Carter, an assistant, and Grace Ewell, an assistant. And throughout the government, there has been a recognition that you hire people on their worth and ability and not because of the color of their skin. Furthermore, the Attorney General has moved in on many problems of desegregation in the schools. The question of employment. The president has set up his Fair Employment Hiring Practices Committee under the leadership of Lyndon Johnson. And as a member of that committee and this one of the subcommittees, I know what is being done to induce American industry on a voluntary basis to hire more and more people whose skins might be dark to man the factories and industries of America. And no president has done as much in the field of civil rights through executive action as President Kennedy.
Senator?
You were referring to the President's Committee on Non-Discrimination in Federal Employment, I think. I undertook to get statutory authority for that committee because it was done by executive order. I couldn't get it through a Democrat Congress. I introduced all the President's civil rights bills in the 86th Congress, that's the prior Congress, and what a time we had to get two-thirds of that package through. Now, two bills were introduced in this Congress by Senator Clark of Pennsylvania and Congressman Seller of New York. There were no hearings, there was no action of any kind. And all that the civil rights cause got, my friend, was a two-year extension of the Civil Rights Commission. And to get it done, we had to hook it on to an appropriation bill.
And I recognize...
So that wasn't a very major accomplishment in that field.
In the question of voting rights, where the Attorney General is moving in the assurance of jobs, and in the recognition of the place of the Negro in our society, the President is moving in and has moved in a way that his predecessor and his predecessors never have moved in. And I recognize, truthfully, the difficulty of getting some of these measures through the Congress of the United States. And it's the same combination that has joined time and time again with the Republicans to defeat many measures that has been advocated by the Democratic Party.
The answer has to be amplified a little. I introduced those bills, if you please, fought them through as best I could. But the opposition did not come from the Republican side. The filibuster, on occasions running through 24 hours a day, came from the Democrat side. And consequently, we had to take a half a loaf when we couldn't get a full loaf. But the record of the Republicans under Eisenhower is, in my judgment, a shining record in the field of civil rights.
All you have to do is look at the people and the jobs they hold.
Public school teacher, retired, but not retiring. I'd like to ask Senator Dirksen why, in the light of 100 years now of experience with the Morrill Act, which gives federal aid to our land-grant colleges, which means the state universities, and before the two territories were introduced, they got a two, to the tune of over $200 million a year, with no evidence of bureaucratic interference, why does Senator Dirksen still persist in thinking that federal aid for public schools of America would be subjected to federal control when it has not been done in the state universities?
Well, if memory serves me correctly, I thought that when these grants were made to the land-grant colleges, there was an obligation and a responsibility for those colleges to carry on military training and train the youth of the country. And there was a definite quid pro quo for it. And when the money was turned over to them, that was the end of it. But what we have now is a proposal to make grants for classrooms, to pay portions of teacher salaries, to subsidize scholarships, and a great many other things. And just spell it out and take a look at the legislation and the language, and you'll see some controls in the very bill that came before the Senate and the House. And nobody who has a facility for interpreting language could read it without looking down the road to see what the ultimate end was going to be.
I would remark on that this way. The federal government today, in all phases of education, expends $2,700,000,000. That's a lot of money. And at no time has Senator Dirksen or any other Republican or Democrat on the floor of the House or the floor of the Senate ever presented to the American people or their colleagues in Congress that there has been the exercise of federal control in the expenditure of that money in all phases of education. And if there is no control when $2,700,000,000 is spent a year, I don't think there would be any control if $325 million was spent, as this lady points out.
I understand all those special programs, the Smith-Hughes Act, the Smith-Dean Act, and all the rest. We've been through that lesson book, and they set on an entirely different base from what was proposed in the federal aid to education bill.
Gentleman there.
Paul Simon is my name. Senator, the deficiencies that may exist in the accomplishments of the Kennedy administration, in part, don't you feel, should be laid to Republican leadership, which has not followed through on a Republican platform they went to the American people with in 1960, and I cite particularly, since you mentioned civil rights, your vote against the change in the Senate rules on filibustering.
Well, first I must correct my distinguished friend with respect to voting on Senate rules. I joined with the majority leader of the Senate in signing a cloture petition within a few days after this session adjourned, and then voted against the motion to table it in the hope that we could get around to Rule 22. And my friend from Troy, Illinois, ought to go back and more carefully examine the record, and then he'll know what the score is.
I think you will find on many of these parliamentary maneuvers on civil rights, there are always a substantial number of Republicans voting with the Democrats to keep it under wraps.
Gentlemen, I can give you about 30 seconds each, or possibly a bit less than that, to answer this question. How do you think the Kennedy administration will make out in the next session of Congress, Senator Dirksen?
Well, I'll give you a one-sentence answer. And this notwithstanding the fact that for 14 years I have served with Mr. Kennedy in the House of Representatives and the Senate, and I own him as a friend. But a president gets his chance. And I would say now that not only is the honeymoon over, but the moneymoon is also over.
First, may I say that the President of the United States, in the absence of some military crisis, will present a balanced budget to the people of this country next year. Secondly, the President and the administration will again go to the people in the next few months to try to get their program across to the people of this country. And if the people, like Senator Dirksen and that combination of Republicans and some of the Democrats, oppose, goodbye Republican Party in the 1962 election.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll be telling you about our next debate on the nation's future after these words about the 1962 Mercurys.
Meet the good-looking 1962 Mercury Comet and the good-looking 1962 Dorothy Collins.
Bill Collins. You say that about every girl under this come-hither roofline.
Drive, Dorothy.
Okay.
You're about to reveal why Mercury Comet rides smoother than other compacts.
I am?
Sure, longest wheelbase in the compact class. Okay, back it up.
Easy.
Now, everybody knows the price is right, with or below most compacts.
Way below some.
Now, up you go to show Comet's high resale record, worth more when you sell it than other compacts.
Who'd ever sell such a fun car?
Your Mercury dealer sells fun cars, in each size. The compact Mercury Comet. The big, luxurious Mercury Monterey. Best looking buys, now in each size.
That's the end of this debate on the nation's future. This is Edwin Newman. Thank you and good night.